There's a part of this very familiar text in John that caught my attention, and I did flirt with the idea of inviting you to kind of replicate that in some ways. We're told Jesus came and stood among the disciples, although the door was locked, and he offered them a greeting of shalom, peace be with you. And he did it again after they were overjoyed. And then it said, and then Jesus breathed on them. They felt the breath of God on their very cheeks. And I thought, you know, that might be a good idea. Maybe to invite the congregation to just turn and breathe on each other. And then I thought, you know, they might say, you've got to be kidding me. They might complain about breath and all kinds of things. I don't know. But the point was indeed to try to welcome the Spirit who is here that comes through Christ. That expression, you've got to be kidding me, is one I'm sure many of you have used. It's found in common cultural parlance. It's found in Hollywood movies like the Transformers, like He's Just Not That Into You, which I didn't see, by the way, but I'm told. Found even on the lips of commentators after that Florida court acquitted Casey Anthony of murder that everyone thought she was guilty of. You've got to be kidding me. It's even found in literature, Chronicles of Narnia, after Trumpkin is rescued. And Susan gives David his sword, gives Peter the sword. It dawns on Trumpkin who they really are, and he says, you've got to be kidding me. You are the kings and queens of old? I don't have proof, but I can only imagine that 100 years ago, after news of the sinking of the Titanic reached the shores of England and other places, that not a few people uttered, you've got to be kidding me. It's an expression that connotes disbelief. Disbelief when that which one expected, whether positive or negative, comes into one's settled thoughts and imagination and disrupts and upsets and turns it over. You've got to be kidding me. Sometimes it can be as simple as somebody reporting an excellent mark on a paper from school where they had usually been getting not so excellent marks. Now the response shouldn't be, you got to be kidding me if you're a parent. It should be, that's wonderful. But they may be thinking it. It could be more serious indeed when you hear your friend, the long-lasting couple, the news of their separation. You've got to be kidding me. It could be a joy that overwhelms you, but it nonetheless is surprising and shocking and maybe causes you a little bit of unsettled nerves when you hear someone who was deathly ill and written off somehow has made a miraculous recovery and the news reaches your ears and you utter, you've got to be kidding me. There's something about that expression, I think, that helps us investigate what are our assumptions, what are our expectations, and it invites us to plumb the very depths of the doubts that we carry with us. I kind of agree with Tennyson, who says there's more faith in honest doubt, believe me, than in half the creeds. And Frederick Buechner, who famously said, doubts are the ants in the pants of faith. They keep it awake and moving. You see, the thing is, for too long, and I think the church has to take some responsibility for this, that we have taught people to be afraid of, to be ashamed of almost, of their doubts. Believe. Have faith. Don't doubt. And so people have hidden what are realistic engagements with challenging aspects of faith because they are afraid that they would come under sanction if they show they don't quite believe as Orthodox Church says they ought to. We have done a disservice. And that is why I'm thankful for stories like these. Stories like this particular text that is read often on the Sunday after Easter. We need to explore it to try to understand something of what we are given permission to do and to be. It's not a story primarily about doubt. It is the relationship of doubt and faith together. It is an engagement in authentic grasping after the mystery that is God, that you and I have permission to embark upon. Jesus comes into the room and comes into a context of fear. Remember, the disciples have abandoned Jesus when news of his arrest and impending crucifixion, they just hightailed it out of there. Only the women remained, the women disciples. There they are, huddled together, afraid. Jesus bursts into that context of fear. The doors are closed. Very interesting word in Greek, kleso, closed. But Jesus comes and speaks a word of peace to them and calls them out of that fear into a community of faith and purpose. Ecclesia, related to kleso, closed, open, called out. But Thomas wasn't there. Thomas wasn't there, and who knows why. I like to think maybe in my mind's eye, Thomas was really the only brave one around them. They're huddled together there because of fear. Somebody's got to go get food. Somebody's got to get provision. Somebody's got to go out. Thomas wasn't there. We don't know why. But Thomas comes back and the disciples tell him, "We have seen the Lord." You've got to be kidding me, is what I'm sure Thomas thought. Well, it's not quite that way in the Greek. It says, unless I see with my eyes, touch with my finger, thrust my hand in his side, I won't believe. Why should he believe them? A bunch of cowardly, afraid disciples. Why should he believe them? There's something credible about their testimony. He's been with them. He knows about it. And why is it that Thomas gets the moniker after this story, Doubting Thomas? Why don't we ever hear denying Peter, abandoning disciples? Why is Thomas singled out? Thomas is being realistic to some extent. Thomas, we have seen the track record of Thomas. When Jesus announced to his disciples that he was going, and he got news of Lazarus and he was going there, Thomas is the one, let's go with him. When he announced that he was the one, he was going to experience crucifixion and death, Thomas says to his disciples, let's go and die with him. Thomas has a track record of faith and accompaniment. Thomas is bewildered at what they are reporting. Thomas is one that we see who throws his whole self in. One of the phrases that needs to be unpacked a little bit is how Jesus responds to Thomas. Jesus responds to the very request that Thomas has. Unless I see, unless I put, unless I trust. And 8 days later, we're told that Jesus comes back and addresses Thomas specifically, and all of them with the same words, peace be with you. But he addresses the content of Thomas's doubts. He says, see my hands, unless I see. Put your finger. Thrust your hand. The content of his doubt, Jesus is willing to address. He's willing to come alongside what those questions are in you and in me. You see, there's something about this text also that gets skimmed over that I think you and I can find our place in two spots. We're told when Thomas's name is first introduced in the text, in brackets it's often put, called Didymus. Thomas was called, that word means twin. Thomas had a twin. How come we don't hear about that twin? I'm wondering if theologically that John's community includes that particular parenthetical comment to invite you and to invite me into this story. Could it be that Thomas's twin is you and me? That we are the ones who, like Thomas, can vicariously ask the questions of faith and doubt about this story about which we may be afraid to admit to ourselves or to others. There we find ourselves pushing a little bit, pushing back against the testimony of the gathered community and wanting to find out for ourselves. Like Thomas, our twin. Unless I see. And Jesus comes alongside and addresses the content of our doubt. You see, I think it requires of us a certain courage to be honest about our doubts and the nature of them, how they came about, and what we're doing about them. You see, it's very interesting. There's some people that I've met and have conversation and host conversations about who tell me all about them doubting. And I've come to learn after 25 years of ordained ministry, almost 26, that doubts are not all the same. In fact, all doubts are not created equal. Let me put it that way. People find themselves in doubt for a host of reasons. Sometimes it has to do with intellectual acceptability. People find themselves in circle of friends and others or reading or literature, and it has become respectable to be a doubter, respectable to throw out the things of faith and the things of mystery, just throw it out because that, after all, is not rational and intellectually appropriate. So people's doubts sometimes have been brought on by a submission to an intellectual identity, as it were. Now, I'm not speaking against intellect. I pray to God I have a little bit of it. But I am saying that if that becomes that which one worships over against other things, explore that. Offer that to Jesus. Says, unless you can prove somehow and engage my intellectual doubt, I will not believe. Some people find themselves in doubt because of something that has happened that has seriously threatened the settled notions of faith that they've had. They have a loved one, perhaps, that they had prayed for earnestly to recover from an illness or an accident, and it didn't happen. And because it didn't happen, I don't believe anymore. Some people find their doubts are a result of sins that they refuse to face up to. Some people doubt because of deep personal wounding. I've gone to church. I have put my faith in all kinds of things about that church. And do you know what she did to me? What he said to me? He's supposed to be a Christian. She's supposed to be. Do you know what? I'm never going back there. I doubt that whole crap anyway. We need to find out what has occasioned the doubt so that we can bring that to Jesus and to see what else is at work. Maybe we're afraid to believe because others will think of us facile, infantile, stupid. So it may be that our sense of self and our esteem and our sense of integrity and identity is threatened, overly so, by other people's opinions. So it may be as we explore and explicate the reasons for our doubt, it reveals more about ourselves and what could be possible if we address, turn, and face it head on. Thomas invites us to do that. And Jesus' response to Thomas is an invitation to do something about it. You see, Jesus says, and it's often translated again, sometimes that's why you need to go back to the original languages to try to see the nuances. The response that is carried there is that Jesus says, stop doubting, believe. The tense of the Greek, however, suggests what he's saying is, do not continue in your doubt, but believe. It doesn't say don't have doubts. See, some people read that and say, well, you're not allowed to have doubts. Jesus said, don't doubt. No. Jesus acknowledges the reality of doubt. Don't continue in it. In other words, don't leave it unexamined. Don't just be complacent about it and happy about your doubt. Nurse your doubt. Be proud of your doubt. I know people who brag about their doubt. Jesus is saying, do something about it. Thomas did something about it. The byproduct of wounds. Perhaps a person didn't get thanked and thought that they should be. Someone has betrayed a confidant. All kinds of reasons why people doubt. So all doubts are not created equal. Find out if you have doubts, and all of us do. I have doubts. Find out what is the basis of them, the reason for them, and what you're doing about them. Because God's big enough to handle your doubt. Jesus proved big enough to handle the doubt of Thomas. You see, one of the things we have to recognize, I believe, is the way in which faith and doubt belong together. The way in which they're intertwined. And the way in which healthy doubt, faithful doubt, actually builds faith. Because faith, without any kind of healthy doubt at all, becomes certainty. And we're not called to be certain, we're called to be faithful. What doubt, healthy doubt does is challenge our faith to keep it, as Buechner said, ants in our pants, to keep it alive. Some interesting things about Thomas that we know certainly by reputation and history. The towns of Kodungallur and Kollam in Kerala, India, they know the answer to Thomas's working out of his doubt. You see, history tells us that Thomas, as Jesus came to the disciples and gave them that commission, in the end of Matthew 28, and here's a very interesting thing. In the end of Matthew 28, Jesus comes to his disciples, and the phrase says, "And they worshipped him, but some doubted." And right after that, we hear Jesus says, "Authority has been given to me. I command you to go and preach the gospel." To the community of those who worshipped him and to those who doubted, without distinction, Jesus sends them both out to spread the gospel. So some people say, well, you know, I can't share my faith, or I can't explore my faith, or I can't do this, or I can't do that because I have doubts. Guess what? Jesus doesn't let you off the hook because you have doubts. There's still work to be done. And Thomas took that seriously because, remember, his confession was, "My God and my Lord." He transitioned through his doubt. He was met by Jesus at the point of his doubt, invited to do something about it, and he responded. He responded. We're told that he went to India and spread the gospel there. There are churches today that still hold his name. The Church of Bar Toma, son of Thomas, in India. The Christians, mostly in the southern part of India, continue giving thanks for the spreading of that rigorous alternative vision that Thomas brought. His doubts and faith, hand in hand, willing to share the gospel. There's a church in Helsinki that every year holds a service in tribute to Thomas. And it invites people and says, "All sinners welcome, all doubters, bring your questions and skepticism. Come and worship in the spirit of Thomas. And leave this place kindled with faith." Now, it's not only personal doubts of faith. There are things that also cause us to say, "You've got to be kidding me." Like probably what happened when you heard Matt read that scripture from Acts. In the early church, the apostles gathered together and they preached, and the people came and they sold property and brought it and laid it at the disciples' feet, so nobody was in need. Everybody had enough. I can hear it now. "You've got to be kidding me." Yeah, right. You see, Acts is a very real book, the Acts of the Apostles. It tells us of how the church was at its best, but also the conflicts and the difficulties of the church. They, like us, are as flawed as ever. But when people got the glimpse of the resurrection story and the impact and transformation that Jesus made, not only in personal life, but in community life, we saw radical reorganization of economics, of life and power structure. And that can still happen. It is inspired even to today. Wendy pointed out a story I didn't see but looked up online that was on last night. Maybe some of you saw that. But I saw in the spirit of what we're talking about, things that may seem incredulous. It was called, entitled Seeking Peace on CTV. Ronnie, I just wanted to get his name. I had his name here. Ronnie Eldry is his name. Ronnie Eldry is an Israeli graphic designer living in Tel Aviv. And very recently, hearing the mounting tension that is happening geopolitically in the world between Israel and Iran, Israel not ruling out a preemptive strike against the nuclear installations, there's great, great tension that is building. And Ronnie Eldry and his wife decided that they were going to reach out to the common people of Iran. And through a web-based online, not petition, but initiative, he and his wife are pictured holding, each of them, one of their children with the message, "Iranians, we love you." And that has spread, and other Israelis have joined it in a thunderous expression of love. "We love you. We don't want to bomb you. We love you. Our government does not represent our position." And the response has started to come back from common Iranians who were saying, "You made me cry when I saw you and your wife holding that child." These expressions of love are beginning to make a difference. Some people would look at that and say, "You've got to be kidding me." But you see, the reality of the power of the resurrection and the power of the good news of Jesus Christ is such that things that we may not expect, things that we have been led to write off, are now possible. Not only possible, but within our grasp to participate in, to support, to encourage. That power brings life and hope and peace and justice. So may you, and may I, challenge the settled imagination and thoughts we have with the intrusion of the resurrection news from Jesus Christ. I want to leave you with some questions, if you would. Things that you can ponder over the week. Can you think of scars that tell something about who one is and what matters most? Think about people you know. Somehow the truth of their identity is bound up with what you know about the wounds in their life. Can't be separated from that. See, Jesus was no longer imprisoned by the power of death, but he still had his scars visible. His wounded identity carried on into his resurrected life. We can be redeemed and resurrected, as it were, but still bear evidence of our wounds. They are part of what makes us who we are. What words would you put to the meaning of Jesus' scars? What role has doubt played in your life and in your faith? And what are you doing about it? May it be that when people see your life and hear your witness, when people hear of the witness and the life and goings-on of Parkdale, that their response would be more often, "You've got to be kidding me," because of the way in which we love and serve and forgive and reach out to the poor and seek justice and care for people and host their doubts. Because that will be more characteristic of our life together rather than, "You've got to be kidding me. Somebody else has left because they've been hurt. Because there's been friction and fighting." Let our witness glorify God. Let people be incredulously responsive to the fact that we resemble a community that worships Jesus and follows in his way. Doubts and faith and all. You've got to be kidding me. Amen.